25. They'll be placed near roads, often in the parking strip between the sidewalk and the road. Portland Parks and Recreation Director Adina Long said, quote, "Everyone, regardless of where we live, deserves safer, cleaner, healthier neighborhoods. It's a matter of public well-being. The free street tree program is a step in the right direction," end quote. Priority for these trees is given to areas of northeast and southeast Portland that have far less trees than the west side does. This contributes to markedly hotter weather in these parts of the city, which is a big concern as the city gets more frequent heat waves as a result of climate change. Trees can also improve road safety by enclosing areas and encouraging people to drive slower. Parks and Rec will maintain and water the trees for 3 years after they plant them in neighborhoods like Buckingham, Wilkes, Kenton, and King.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 9th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Rachel Garcia. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Roz Brown, Alex Gonzalez, and Mark Richardson. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Nathan Vandiver.
And I'm Danny Shy. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. Our last episode was a great discussion with a Forest Service scientist and a forest ecologist with the Nature Conservancy about the effects of various fire treatments on subsequent fire behavior. And while I appreciated their perspective and the research that they brought to the table, I wanted to bring in a different conservation-oriented viewpoint on fire and forest ecology. It's important to remember that Western forests have existed and thrived long before humans arrived in North America. The impulse to manage the world around us is an ingrained human trait and not even particularly unique to humans. However, while indigenous people throughout the Americas sustainably and vibrantly stewarded their land for millennia, Western notions of forest management and stewardship have proven disastrous everywhere they have been forced upon landscapes and communities. So we as a society should be very cautious and humble about the idea that we can improve on nature, especially as we enter a deepening phase of the climate crisis caused by humans, of course. I promise that Coast Range Radio is not becoming a wildfire policy podcast. But wildfire policy is the number one factor driving massive landscape management decisions across all ownership types. Okay, actually, maybe the number two factor after profits for the 1%. Regardless, it's especially relevant as the Forest Service seems to be going all in on aggressive, ramped-up logging in the name of wildfire management in its recently released draft environmental impact statement on its plan to amend the landmark Northwest Forest Plan. And that was a lot, so in case you don't know, an Environmental Impact Statement, or EIS, is a document produced by an agency as part of a mandatory process assessing environmental impacts for a given project or policy, and a draft EIS is the public's opportunity to weigh in on the agency's assessment. Now, some people call that genuine public engagement, and some people call the way it plays out in reality a farce with a predetermined outcome. Not for me to say, of course. We'll have more to say about how you can meaningfully engage, though, in the process and fight back against the bad regardless. And we'll begin a whole series on the Northwest Forest Plan, DEIS, in January. So with all of that in mind, I'm sharing a talk today that the Sierra Club's Stop Clearcutting California team put on with conservationist George Werthner as part of their Forest Protection Forum series. George Werthner is a well-known ecologist and author who's dedicated his career to studying and advocating for wilderness and wildlife conservation. He's the author of a huge number of books on environmental issues and natural history, including co-authoring and editing Wildfire, A Century of Failed Forest Policy, which is the focus of the talk that you're going to hear today. And I felt like it was too good to edit into one episode, so I'm breaking it in two. This is part one, and we'll put out part two in a couple weeks. And if you want to hear them both together, I'll also be putting out a full version in the podcast feed of Coast Range Radio. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can email me anytime, michael@coastrange.org. Okay, here's part one of George Werthner on Wildfire, A Century of Failed Forest Policy.
This is the cover of the book that I did on Wildfire. It's a coffee table book. And part of the theme of it at the time was to try to counter the idea that was prevalent and still largely is prevalent that all wildfires are somehow ecologically damaging and should be suppressed. And part of what we did in the book was have a lot of photos of places that had burned at one time or another. It might have been the year before, it might have been 10 years before, or whatever, and say that if you like the way this landscape looks, and a lot of times the pictures are pretty beautiful, then you have to accept that wildfire is an important ecological process. So that was the concept behind the book. And I've been interested, a little background, I've been interested in fire ecology since I started college at the University of Montana. And part of it was I had this professor who taught botany there, and I took three different botany classes from him. But anyway, almost all of them had a big important thing about wildfire ecology, which at the time was pretty unique to have somebody with that kind of interest. So that's how I first got interested in it. And the next really big event in fires was the 1988 Yellowstone fires. And I was living in Livingston, Montana at the time, just north of Yellowstone. And pretty much every day I was going down to the park to watch and see how the fires were burning during that summer. And that really kind of was a big change in my thinking about fires in general and fire ecology. And I'll mention it now, but I'll emphasize this later. And part of the change was I came to understand that the weather controls large wildfires more than anything else. And it doesn't matter what you do in terms of fighting fires. It doesn't matter what you've done in the past about fuel reductions or whatever. If you've got high winds and high air temperatures and low humidity and so forth, fires are pretty much unstoppable. And that's how it was in 1988 in Yellowstone Park. In fact, half the acreage that burned that summer burned in just 4 days when the wind was blowing 50 miles an hour. So that was a pivotal change in my thinking about stuff. Anyway, so we'll go on from there. What I'm going to talk about here is what I think you can characterize as a paradigm shift. Like Copernicus, who challenged the idea that the sun circled the earth is the center of the universe, new insights of fire ecology are changing these old ideas about fire. And that's, keep that in mind. And the other thing about paradigm shift is they don't happen quick. So a lot of what I'm going to tell you, you're not going to hear from other people because The paradigm shift takes many years to sort of, a lot of times people have to die and stuff before the concepts change. So it may seem counterintuitive. For example, you can go out and look at the sun and you can see it circling around in the sky, and it rises in the east, sets in the west. And it's intuitive that the sun circles the earth, but it's just not true. So it's the same with a lot of the things I'm going to tell you. Just kind of keep that analogy in mind. It may not make sense at first, but I think if I introduce you to some of these concepts, you will get more and more confirmation over time. The other thing important to note is science changes. So whatever I say today may be revised, disputed, and reversed by future research. And I always like to use this analogy. At one time, it was assumed that skull size determined intelligence. And of course, men have bigger skulls. So the implication was that men were more intelligent. So that's been thrown to the wayside. But I use that as an example how some of the assumptions we have may change over time. So a couple of main themes. One, as I suggested at the beginning, large wildfires, and large, I'm talking about these fires that burn, you know, 10,000, 20,000, 100,000, and maybe even a million acres at a time, are driven by climate and weather, not fuels. And fire suppression has had little influence on what burns and how it burns. And fire suppression is one of the things you'll hear all the time, that the reason we have big fires is because fires have been stopped and fuels have built up. And I'm going to challenge that assumption here. Fuel treatments, i.e. logging, prescribed burning, under severe wildfire weather are ineffective. And the reason, there's an important qualifier in there, severe wildfire weather. Some of these things might work under conditions of low to moderate fire weather, but they fail when you get the severe fire weather, which is less than 1% of all fires. In fact, even a small percentage of that 1%. And another theme is high severity wildfires create a unique habitat of snag fire forests. And I want to address that a little further on. And our forests are not unhealthy. That's another justification given for logging, because the assumption is because of the assertion that fire suppression changed the forest composition, therefore they're not healthy. And what I like to say is the solution is what's called chainsaw medicine. In other words, we go out there, the trees are unhealthy, so we got to cut them down, kill them, so that we can make a healthy forest. Just keep chainsaw medicine in mind. And the final thing is, you know, what do we do? We don't want homes and communities to burn down. And really, the best thing you can do is harden your home, and that includes non-flammable roofs, clean out gutters, et cetera, and clear vegetation 100 feet from home. The picture on the right there was taken at Paradise, California, where the campfire burned through a couple of years ago. And one of the things to look at all the green trees around that house, and yet it burned to the ground. And the reason was something about the house, I don't know what it was because all I saw was the foundation, but something about the house made it flammable, and burning embers, and this is where the high severity fire come along. They're usually wind-driven events, burning embers, they'll land on, say, a roof full of pine needles or whatever, and the house can burn to the ground, even though right around it, none of the forest is ignited. So I'm going to use some terms, fire severity terms. A high severity fire is where the majority of the trees are killed, and you can kind of see that in this picture here in the upper top part. And then you have mixed severity, which is, you know, as it says, it's some high severity and some low severity. In other words, you got some trees that survived, some that didn't. And then you have low severity down here, where really there's hardly any evidence that any trees died. But in reality, probably all fires are mixed severity, even the high severity, because like up here, up in the top up here, you know, there's stretches here that didn't burn either. So if you mix these together, you get a mixed severity fire. Okay. We have all sorts of things listed as responsible for increasing large fires, such as fire suppression, lack of Indian burning, and so forth. But the driving force of all wildfires today is climate warming due to carbon emissions. And all the recent climate models showing fire increases are related to summer heat and vapor pressure deficit. And another important thing to keep in mind is human-caused fires burn faster. and they kill more trees than natural fires. And studies have shown that human ignitions is to blame for 84% of all the wildfires in the ICs and 97% of all those that threaten homes. So trying to reduce human ignitions is an important part of the equation. All right. And an interesting thing is that besides the human-caused fires, a lot of them start within 300 feet of a road. And the reason I mention this is because one of the things the Forest Service is doing logging, or what they call thinning, to reduce the fuels, and they often have to build roads. And yet, in building the roads, they wind up creating access for people and more likely to have a fire start. So there's this counter thing that happens, that the more roads you have through the forest, the more likely you are to get some sort of ignition. Now, another thing that people are really surprised about is that most fires remain small and they go out without any suppression. If you do nothing, most fires will just self-extinguish. And there's very few studies to sort of support this, because we're always trying to put out fires all the time. But in between 1972 to 87 in Yellowstone, they had 235 back country fires, and 222 of them burned 5 acres or less, and only one was bigger than 1,000 acres, and all of them went out without suppression. But since we don't let nature do this, we always take credit that, you know, we go in, the fire is going to probably go out unless it's the extreme fire weather conditions, and then we, quote, put it out and save the day. And the other thing to keep in mind, again, that how small most of these fires are. So here's some statistics between 1980 and 2003 in the Rocky Mountains. There were 56,320 fires, and most of them burned less than an acre. And 98% of these fires accounted for only 4% of the area burned. So in other words, most fires hardly burn anything. On the other hand, 2% of all fires accounted for 96% of the acreage burned. That's the fires that are burning under extreme fire weather. And then if you take a subset of that 96%, you find that 0.1% of all blazes are responsible for half of the acreage's charred. And so that's a pretty amazing statistic. In other words, and where this gets back to policy is all our forest policy, thinning, the prescribed burning, and all this stuff that we're doing is designed to stop the fires, but the fires that it's trying to stop are the big fires, which that doesn't work for. So evidence abounds that forest management does not and has not significantly altered fire spread under extreme fire weather conditions. I always got to put that out there, because as I said, some of these things will work under less than extreme conditions, but then they're not really usually a threat, because they'll either go out themselves or they're pretty easy to put out. But this picture shows where there's significant clear cuts, and you can see all around the clear cuts there are burns. So the clear cutting, which is zero fuel, didn't have any effect. Another thing is that a lot of our whole idea of fuel reductions and the IR fire suppression is based on fire scar studies. And this is the almost all the information we have about what is the typical fire regime, how frequent fires occur, and so forth, is from studies of fire scars, as you see on this tree. And what they do, you go walking around in the woods and you find a tree like this that's been scarred, and you either cut it down or you core it, and you can tell by counting the rings in the tree the interval between frequent fires. In other words, for every time there's a fire, there'll be a scar like this, but this is all the way back through the interior of the tree. And so you count the years between those fires, and then you come up with your typical fire rotation. And here's an example of what it would look like if you were to cut the tree down. Now, there's a lot of problems with fire scar studies, even though this is the predominant way we come up with our sort of management regimes. One, it's a non-random selection of scar trees. In other words, I've done this stuff. You walk through the woods and you look for scars on trees. You don't take a test of every tree out there. So you're right there sort of having a bias. The analogy I make is it'd be like going into a bar and then asking everybody who likes beer to raise their hands, and you find, you know, 95% of the people who raise their hands like beer. And then you say, in the city of whatever, blah, 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 you know, 95% of the people like beer. Well, you've got a non-random selection when you go into a bar. Anyway, the other thing to keep in mind is the average fire interval, in this case, is every 10 years, but there was one interval where it was 64 years. So a 60-year fire-free period, is that unnatural? And the reason I bring that up is you could argue just as much that that might be the more normal situation. And finally, and this is the biggest thing that happens, I'm not going to get into all the nuances here in the weeds, but just keep in mind that the way a lot of these are done is they'll look at all these fire scars and they add them together every year that a fire occurred, and then they put it on a 100-year scale and then divide by those number of fires. The problem is that every one of these scars, this is one tree, and you may not find any scars of all those years in other trees, but we put them all together. So it could be one tree got burned, and yet we're saying that the whole area burned on that kind of interval. So just keep that in mind. The other thing is that other ways of reconstructing fire history have different results, typically much longer fire intervals, and they include air photo interpretation, charcoal studies where they look at the charcoal in the soil, sediments, or sometimes in lake beds, pollen studies, which they look at to see if there's been a big shift in the vegetation, because after fire, often you have different species there. And so you can postulate that that's due to a fire, and government land office reports, GLO reports. This is a really kind of a new thing that's I actually support a lot. I used to be a surveyor, so I know what this is like. And when you're surveying, you go through across the land, you note when you change any kind of vegetation. So you're going along, you say, okay, I'm in a spruce forest here for half a mile. Now I'm in a burnt spruce fire where all the trees are killed for another quarter mile, and so forth. So you can read those reports and get some sense of what the fire situation was like. And these government land office reports were done 100 years or more ago. So before there was any fire suppression or any other changes that would interrupt what you could categorize as sort of the more natural condition. So anyway, keep in mind that other ways of determining this stuff. And so here's an example. This was a general land office findings in Eastern Oregon. And some of the Forest Service out in this part of Oregon says that the majority of trees here were burned by frequent low severity fires. But this general land office report, which was looking at done in the 1860s, so before there was hardly anybody even living in Oregon, found that only about 13.5% of the forests were low density, which is what the Forest Service says they're supposed to be like. Also, shade tolerant fir were historically 17% of the trees, and that's another thing. Where they find fir trees, which the big tree in the foreground here is a fir tree, the Forest Service claims that that's not normal. You shouldn't have those trees there. And then finally, the low severity fire dominated only 23.5% of the land area, and high severity was found on 26% of the forest area. The point being is that a different interpretation over a whole landscape. And another thing about the surveying is you're going in a straight line. So you're doing a random interception of the forest. You're not going out of your way to say, oh, it's burned over there, so I'll go over there and do my survey there and show that there was more fire or whatever. The central finding is that high severity fires exceeding historic rates are not supported by the evidence in the review. In other words, people are saying because of fire suppression, all we're having bigger and more frequent large fires. But if you go back in time a little bit, you don't have to go back too far. For example, in Montana and Idaho in 1910, there were 3.5 million acres burned in one fire. There's no fire that's happened, well, since I've been watching this stuff in more recent times, that big. And that happened in 1910. So we've had large fires. And in 1929, for example, over 50 million acres burned across the West. 50 million acres. Today, if 10 million acres burned, that's a big fire year. So even at the last century, there were many years where there were huge fires. So anyway, the traditional reference conditions of low severity fire regimes are inaccurate for most forests of Western North America. Mixed severity fires that include ecologically significant amounts of weather-driven high severity fire. And the reason this is important is this whole idea that low severity fire is supposed to be the natural situation just doesn't exist in most plant communities. And I'll have a little bit more about that in a minute. But here's another thing that you have to keep in mind is what I call the shifting baseline. And these graphs show the millions of acres burned and then in different years. And you can see around 1970, it reached a low point. And you'll hear the agencies all the time talking about, well, fires are increasing. They're getting larger and larger. And they use as a starting point the 1970s. Well, there's a reason they do that because, yeah, they are getting larger since 1970. But if you were to start at the 1900s, you might find that actually they're not too much bigger than they were in the past. And part of the reason is that, again, how the climate and weather controls things. So offshore currents called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation creates cool weather and warm weather. And as you can see in this chart that started around in the early 1900s, there were many millions of acres burned. And then the climate changed in about the 1940s and so forth and got cooler and moister. And just think to yourself, what happens when it's cooler and moist? Well, if it's cool and moist, if it's moist, you're going to get fewer ignitions. So you're going to have less acreage burned, which is showing up in the graph there. You're also just going to have more moisture for trees to survive as seedlings. So you will get denser forests as a result. So the very conditions that they're attributing to fire suppression are the things that happen because of the weather. And then in the 1980s, the climate changed and we're in a warmer period, mostly because of human climate warming. And so we're getting bigger fires. But back in the 1970s and 40s and all through that time, glaciers were expanding. You know, you hear about how glaciers are disappearing from Glacier National Park now and so forth. But it wasn't that long ago that they were getting bigger. When I was first starting school at the University of Montana, some of my professors were talking about in classes about the danger of the new ice age that was starting. That there was this fear that glaciers were going to expand, you know, and come down out of Canada and take over the cornfields in Iowa or whatever. And that was driven by this cool, moist climate. And so, again, this is indirect confirmation that the climate was different then and than today. And even if we go back long term, we see this. This is a chart, and the chart is showing the periodic droughts and periodic wetter periods. Two things I want to point out. This wetter period here, that's like the little ice age that came along. And a very interesting thing about it is about the time when the West was getting explored, you know, it's the first fur trappers and traders were coming out, like in New Mexico was being colonized by the Spanish in the 1600s. And, you know, Lewis and Clark came through in 1806 and so forth. It was a lot wetter then and cooler. But if you go back further, like in the 900 AD and 10,000 AD and 1150 AD and so forth, that was the medieval warm spell, and it was warmer than normal. And you had, many things happening then, like the Anasazi Pueblo Indians abandoned their dwellings in Utah and other places to move to permanent water sites. This was the climate change. At the same time, there were large fires happening, though, because of that. And in fact, another thing is funny about that same time, that's when Greenland was colonized by the Vikings, and it was greener because it was a warmer, drier climate at that time. And then one of the things that led to the demise of the Viking colonies there, it got cooler and cooler. In fact, they found, you know, like they would go to cemeteries in Greenland after the colonists disappeared there, and they found that the graves got shallower and shallower because the soil was freezing. They couldn't bury people at a normal depth anymore. Anyway, if large fires drove wildfires, we'd have the largest fires in places like the Oregon Coastal Range because there's more biomass here than any place else. So this idea that fuels are what drives fires. Now, you've got to have some fuels, but in truth, just because you have a lot of fuels doesn't mean you'll get a fire. And what you need to have these conditions: drought, low humidity, high temperatures, and especially wind. And I use this cartoon because I use the analogy when I was learning how to drive a stick shift, I had to learn how to like step on the gas at the same time I was pushing in the clutch and then shift. And I was always screwing up. I was stalling the car out all the time. So, but just turning the car on doesn't mean it's going to go anywhere. You have to shift it. You know, you can have a car full of gas and it won't go anyplace. So you have to have all these things work together. And that's an important thing because there's very few parts of the West where you will get these conditions all in the same place at the same time. But when you do, look out.
And that's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Stay tuned for part two of George's talk, or listen to the entire talk by searching for Coast Range Radio on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any other podcast app. Huge thanks to Silas, Karen, and Jennifer with the Stop Clearcutting CA team from the Sierra Club for putting on the Forest Protection Forum series. You can find all of their webinars, including a great talk from our very own Chuck Willer, just by searching Stop Clearcutting CA, as in California. Or you can find links to that and more in the show notes of our podcast feed. Thanks so much for listening. My email is michael@coastrange.org, and we'll be back with part two in a couple weeks.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
We know a KBOO community membership is at the top of everyone's wish list this season. Give the gift of supporting grassroots community media by making a donation during KBOO's Catalog of Connections campaign.